Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Can we start? All right, welcome to our subcommittee meeting. I trust you saw the agenda, and if you have anything to add to the agenda items, if not, can we consider it approved? Yes, the agenda is approved. Thank you very much. Now, let's go to the first agenda item, which is a briefing on Environment and Emergencies Forum, which is scheduled for in September, 26-28 September, in Nairobi this year. Under the theme From Crisis to Opportunity, Building Resilience by Managing Environmental Risk in Emergencies. And I understand that Ms. Wilkie, Mehta, will have a presentation. She's the director of the Ecosystems Division. So,
thank you.
Yes, I will give you the floor, please.
Thank you very much. Right on cue. Actually, the presentation will be made by Ollie Brown, who is the coordinator of the sub-program on disasters and conflict. Ollie.
Very good. Thank you very much. Let's just cue up the – have a very quick presentation for you. I just wanted to talk for 5 or 7 minutes about this really exciting conference that we have, this meeting we have coming up in September. Good morning, everybody. Just check that it's up. So, as Mehta and the chair said, this is the Environment and Emergencies Forum, which is one of the major kind of landmark events of a very old partnership that UN Environment has with the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. It's a partnership that's been going on for 23 years, and we have what we call the Joint Environment Unit, which sits in the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, staffed by staff from both UN Environment and from OCHA, and is a mechanism for us to respond to environmental emergencies extremely fast. It allows us to access the sort of humanitarian response network and to deploy experts through OCHA very quickly. We've deployed experts in as little as 6 hours in the past, but within 24, 48 hours we can deploy experts to the site of an industrial accident, natural disaster, or other environmental emergency. So it's an opportunity for the humanitarian community to bring in the environmental expertise of UN Environment and for us to access the humanitarian community. And so we're looking at, we look at a whole variety of different issues. Over that 23 years, we have responded to 188 different issues in 90 different countries. And typically what we do is we conduct environmental assessments in the context of the environmental emergency to inform decision-making around the humanitarian response, to ensure that immediate pressing environmental issues are dealt with so that they don't make the humanitarian crisis more serious. And so the Environment and Emergencies Forum is our kind of landmark opportunity to bring together experts working on environment and emergencies. And it's, I think, really the only major meeting between the environmental community and the humanitarian community. And we're really excited that for the first time in 23 years it's being held in Nairobi this September. So I just wanted to talk very quickly about that. As Ambassador Pataki said, between the 26th and 28th of September, it's going to be held in the UNON compound here. It will, we hope, be opened by our Executive Director, Eric Solheim, and hopefully the incoming Humanitarian Coordinator as well. And as I was saying, it's a really unique event that we've been organizing every 2 years since 1995. And we aim to bring together 100, 150, maybe more, experts and policymakers working on this intersection between environment and humanitarian response. People from governments, from UN, from academia, civil society, and so on. So in 2015, it was held in Oslo, in Norway, and as I said, in 2017, it'll be held in Nairobi. And it's a platform for taking action to strengthen environmental resilience, to look really at how we can work together to improve the readiness of member states, regional and national organizations, and civil society to both understand, prevent, and respond to the environmental dimensions of emergencies. So in terms of the objectives, I think what we really want it to be is a bridge between the World Humanitarian Summit that took place around the time of the second Environment Assembly in Istanbul last year, and the third Environmental Assembly in December this year. Again, it's often what we're talking about in environmental emergencies are concentrated pollution events, where an industrial accident has led to whatever it may be, a release of cyanide or a release of oil and so on. So I think it's very appropriate that we're talking about environmental emergencies in the run-up to the third assembly. Just in terms of the themes that we're going to be covering, there's three themes that the conference will look at. The first is really the kind of readiness for environmental emergency response. So how can we help countries both to minimize the risk and to respond swiftly when problems do occur? The second issue is how can we work with the humanitarian community to reduce the environmental footprint of humanitarian response? Again, this is perhaps one of the biggest areas of international action, and it's critical that in that immediate environmental response phase, we don't make decisions that lock in unsustainable solutions or that make the existing humanitarian crisis more serious by failing to address a major environmental health problem or a toxic spill or something like that. So it's how can we think about mainstreaming environment into humanitarian response? And then the third issue is how can we work to address some of the environmental impacts of conflict, to understand them, to prevent them, and so on. Again, I think there's a nice link here with some of the discussions during the second Environment Assembly. The other thing I just wanted to mention is that this is also the venue where we give out our environmental emergency Oscars, we like to call them, our Green Star Awards, which is our way of recognizing excellent work that's being done to address the environmental impacts of emergencies. It's a three-way partnership between UN Environment, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and Green Cross International. And we are trying to sort of reward and recognize excellence in three areas: prevention and preparedness, response, and environment in humanitarian action. And I just wanted to show a very quick 2-minute video of one of the winners, if we can get it working, from 2015, which is the Women's Refugee Council. Just hope the volume is working. The volume?
So many factors increase the risk of violence for women and girls in humanitarian settings. One of them is access to cooking fuel and energy. Most food provided by humanitarian agencies needs to be cooked before it can be eaten. This means women must risk their safety, health, and sometimes their lives to collect firewood in order to cook a meal for their families. Deforestation means women must go further and further from camps to find firewood. In fact, refugee women can spend up to 8 hours a day collecting firewood, putting them at risk for physical and sexual attack. At night, lack of access to lighting further increases women's vulnerabilities. It's a real problem when too many people rely on a limited supply of natural resources for survival. The Women's Refugee Commission has been working successfully for nearly a decade to put cooking fuel on the humanitarian agenda. It's clear from our work that protection, livelihoods, and the environment are inextricably linked. Where firewood is the main source of energy, over-harvesting of natural resources can trigger tension between refugees and host communities, increasing the risks to women who collect firewood and preventing any hope of sustainable development. Safe and sustainable access to energy is increasingly recognized as a human right, essential for safety, well-being, and productivity of displaced populations. Our SAFE program goes beyond simply handing out a cook stove or planting a tree. Through a set of comprehensive activities that address the root causes of energy challenges, SAFE helps to protect both people and the environment. Receiving the Green Star Award is meaningful to us because we know that to be effective, we need to collaborate across sectors. We need to take into consideration protection, health, education, livelihoods, and the environment when identifying energy needs and developing sustainable solutions. We have some good examples of how SAFE initiatives can help protect communities and the environment that they live in.
Okay, sorry. Apologies for the sound quality there. It seemed to be a little bit delayed. But I think you get a sense of what we're talking about with the Green Star Awards, which again is a really nice opportunity to recognize excellent work that's happening in this realm of environment and emergencies, and to my knowledge is really the only such award there is. So just as a last slide, how can you get involved? We would really, really like to see as many of you involved as possible in this. The first way is to register. More information can be found at this link here. And to encourage experts in your capitals to come out. Again, we would love this to be an opportunity to share experiences, learn new approaches, build networks, and so on. Associated with that, if you can help us bring in more people, particularly from least developing countries. The more we can make this a global conversation, the more we can learn from each other's experiences. We're going to have a sort of evening event with what they call an Ignite stage to showcase really interesting new ideas, innovative approaches, with sort of rapid-fire 10-minute TED-style talks. So again, if you have something you would like to present or you know somebody who would like to share something around this, a new approach on addressing the link between environment and emergencies, please do let us know. Also, if you'll see on the link, there's more information about the agenda and so on. If you are interested in helping to facilitate or support a session, we'd love to hear from you and so on, and help us to identify solutions and find new partners. If you have any questions or comments or advice now, I'd love to hear them. But also, if you like to contact either the conference organizer, Amelia Wallstrom, directly, you have her email there, or my email is also there as well. So I think that's it for me, and back to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Oli, for the very concise and short presentation. And now I would open the floor if you have any questions related to this agenda item. I give the floor first to Iraq, and after that, DRC.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, I would like to thank Oli Brown for this presentation. We believe it's very important, and there is a connection between emergency and environment. And I would like to request from the Chair and the Secretariat if we can have more information about this, or maybe another session for the countries who are interested to listen. Thank you.
You have the contact, so Oli is the contact here, so you can contact him directly. And anybody else who would like to have more information, DRC.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Oli Brand, for a very comprehensive presentation. Mine is about registration. I can see that the registration is starting March, as it's closing in the end of this month, May, which is almost 3 months or 4 months before the event. So now, during your presentation, you mentioned experts from capital if they can come and attend. So my concern is that the time is very short, as from now, to inform the capital for the expert to be nominee for them to go to be registered. why can't you, so I would suggest to leave it open, maybe to close 1 month or 1 week before, also to leave open for some other who can come and to be registered on arrival. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other intervention? No. Then if you would like to reply or you will reply after, it's your choice.
Certainly. Thank you very much for pointing that out. We certainly will keep the registration open. I didn't realize it had been set with a date to close in May, so we'll keep that open. But thank you very much for pointing that out.
Meta.
Just a short note from me. The reason it was set for the end of May was that we originally scheduled it for June. Now, when we changed it, we obviously didn't change it on the website, so we will make that change. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you very much. We concluded, and thank you, Oli, and thank you, Mette, for being present here. Now, let's go to the next agenda item. It's a briefing on preparation of UN Environment Programme's Frontiers report, which touches on new knowledge on 6 emerging issues, including environmental dimension of antimicrobial resistance, subduing sand and dust storms, environmental displacement, marine protected areas within the context of sustainable development, off-grid solar solutions, and nanomaterials. I would like to ask Jackie to present, to make your presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and it's a great pleasure to be here to give you a first sight of Frontiers 2017. And I must first of all recognize Pinya Sarasas, who is the main editor and who's really been working flat out, I think, to bring what are an extraordinary number of, I won't call them existential threats, but certainly things which we hope will eventually become part of your conversations in the coming discussions in the CPR and thereafter into the Environment Assembly. As you know, the Frontiers report took sort of the place of a lot of monthly updates and then eventually the yearbook. And I think the success of last year's report, which has created and has had resonance in many different settings, is, I think, a testament to the success of having this one yearly picture, looking at the repercussions, but trying to explain it in terms that are not so much scientific, but drawing on science, but trying to look at some of the consequences and very, very strongly creating an outreach to the public. In your briefing, you will have seen that we have 6 topics. I'm going to actually very quickly go over them, but then very, very willing to sort of deep dive into any one of the issues that you might want to think a little bit more about. So let's start then with sand and dust storms. A very topical issue, and one which I think those of you who are looking and listening as to what is happening in the discussions in New York realize that it has risen up the political agenda. We produced a global assessment last year of the science, but I think more and more we're seeing that this is a phenomenon that needs to be addressed at the very local level. Nevertheless, the global statistics and the story that comes through is one which I think we can no longer ignore. It's a combination of natural phenomena, looking at, for example, the Sahara as a dust bowl, if you might consider it in that way, providing nearly 75% of the source material. But let's face it, there are other sources coming on stream. We have sources in Asia, certainly in China, but also in Latin America. So all over the world, there are small places which are beginning to expand due to desertification, due to poor land management, which means that they become, in a way, constituents of the global sand and dust storm phenomenon. Important to make the distinction between sand and dust. Sand is usually comprised or constituted of elements and items and particles that are greater than 60 microns. Dust is less. When we think about just in sheer physics, if you can imagine sand being slightly heavier, of course the distances over which it travels are far less. So the phenomenon that we are concerned with is primarily dust. Nevertheless, sandstorms in certain parts of the world literally asphyxiate. They will kill people because just the sheer weight of material in the atmosphere is such that people cannot avoid it. So dust is a pervasive background issue. Sand is a phenomenon that comes in these rather erratic patterns. If asked, is the phenomenon increasing? Not in a global context on average, but certain parts of the world are experiencing more sand and dust storms than previously. So certainly across North Africa, into West Asia, we see that there are more identified events. There are a number of things that we talk about in the chapter, not least of which are some of the health criteria, the guidelines above which pretty much you can see that we're talking about tens of thousands of particles per micrograms per cubic meter, and the threshold is 50, so you can see already that it is definitely a health issue, not just for humans, but also for livestock, and in fact also for the environment itself. Within cities, it's a particular phenomenon because you get canyoning, and it's very, very difficult to escape from. Some of the data and things that we present are horrifying. We have one or two events where up to 10,000 people have died at one time. So these are real phenomena. And what can we do about it? Well, we reach back into the legacy of good land management practices. Sometimes it's extremely simple. It's about greening. It's about ensuring that we don't allow the advance of deserts into some of our peri-urban and agricultural areas. But it is very, very clear that it's a phenomenon that we are tackling both natural and man-made contributions. Next phenomenon, please. The next one is antimicrobial resistance. Can you just please move the slide on? Thank you. Now, I'm just going to be a bit nerdy here. So many of you will have heard over the years about antibiotic resistance. Antibiotics we often encounter ourselves, and we are often given them as medicines. But in the broader perspective of what we are presenting, we are essentially able to say at this point that we are entering a post-antibiotic era. In other words, the repertoire of pharmaceuticals, either known as antimicrobials or antibiotics, we have antifungals and antivirals, but we're really focusing on the bacterial populations, are such that in years to come, and certainly by 2050, it may be impossible to envisage very simple medical procedures. That is how serious the phenomenon is. Why do I say that we are tackling it today? Well, it's obvious that as the biosphere is responding to bacteria that are now resistant to particular forms of drugs, they're sort of getting together and ganging up. And we've seen the phenomenon in some hospitals. It's called multi-strain resistant. But now we see it in the environment as well. And bacteria have a phenomenal capacity to pass on bits of their genome in the way that they replicate. So they can have pieces of resistance essentially being transferred horizontally through many, many other populations, which normally would never come into contact other than through the fact that we have wastewater that is not controlled or is already contaminated. That we have, for example, outside some pharmaceutical factories, the sloughing off of the kind of pharmaceutical products deposited around these factories is actually creating zones of antibiotic all around the factory spaces. We see it in Cuba, we've seen it in a number of countries around the world. So it's a mixture of a lack of awareness, a lack of regulatory discussions, but also it comes down to the fact that the environment is the ultimate sink. What is the answer? The first line of resistance has to be greater management of municipal waste. It has to be a greater awareness of its usage within the kind of medical and the veterinary practices. But it also means that we have to be vigilant as to our food products, because clearly some of the bacteria that we see now becoming resistant will in fact start to contaminate some of our food. So maybe it's an existential threat, I don't know, but it's certainly out there, and it's certainly something that we as an environmental group need to pay attention to, because the focus is primarily on health, of humans rather than on the environment itself, and it will have an impact on the bacterial populations. The next slide. By the way, I'm putting up the infographics. They're sort of in their final stages, because what we want to be able to do is have the more detailed report, but also then have a very short briefing which you can take out to different settings. The next topic is environmental displacement. We call it, in fact, the Exodus, humans in the Anthropocene. And that is because the Anthropocene, as many of you know, is a description of today's planetary dynamics, which have gone beyond simple natural processes and where man-made and human-induced changes are now leaving a signature at a geological scale. With that in mind, we take a different view then here, and I think you've had briefings on more than one occasion from Meta and her team about the environmental causes of displacement. And really we're trying to highlight here that it's the combination that we are really most concerned about. The statistics you're very familiar with. You know, 125 million people after the Second World War needed help, and now we're up into just 15 million in 1 year. So the numbers are enormous. And I think it's a duty of care that we have to start to consider precisely the sources and causes. And these infographics that we have on the chapter point to not only the loss of water, for example, causing people because of desertification to move, but actually natural disasters and even industrial accidents are reasons for people to move and to never return. I'll go on to the next one, please. Now, the marine story. We're about to go to New York for a long discussion and deep discussions about ocean governance. And I think what we're trying to do here in a part of our outreach for that is really to talk about, do marine protected areas work? Are they effective? How can we make them more efficient? And just to bring some of those big numbers, because in many terms, the marine protected areas have been a big success story. We now have millions of hectares, 18.5 square kilometres, covered by marine protected areas. And that's a very good piece of news. But they do need a special duty of care, a special form of governance. So these are all the kinds of statistics that come up, how many people will benefit from having good resource management via marine protected areas, in addition to management of resources both onshore and along the shore and in the open ocean. Next slide, please. So here, it's really going to the heart of sustainable development. And it's really trying to position marine protected areas as this combination of a top-down governance, the kind of global setting, the bottom-up, the people in the local communities, what they can do, the success stories that present the evidence that it is worth local communities paying in and paying attention and building marine protected areas. And then there's the kind of market brand that we want to see, which governance brings around marine protected areas. So of course the Great Barrier Reef is something which is a core of the tourist industry. People have understood what that means. And ipso facto, you then begin to build up an understanding that natural resource degradation is something that is not good for the planet as well as for the Australian the Australian nation itself. Next slide, please. What we've also tried to do then is to give a sort of sense of, in the iceberg effect, what people normally see and are preoccupied with in many ways, which is the management side, but how important it is to have good governance, to have agreements, to have negotiations that really then influence that top bit of the picture. The management is just the thing that pops out at the end. It's the understanding of the governance. Who's at the table? How is the negotiation? What does the agreement look like? And then we really look at how it's embedded into the sustainable development goals. So marine protected areas do contribute to a number of goals, and not just in productivity terms of fisheries, but in many, many other parts of the whole landscape of the goal structure. Next slide, please. The next one we're looking at is off-grid solar. As you know, around the world, we have tremendous numbers of activities, initiatives to put solar, certainly here in Africa, renewables for all, and so on and so forth. They still are premised primarily around a grid structure, which has, of course, enormous infrastructure costs, maintenance, and in the end, investment. What we are observing, however, is that off-grid is becoming more and more pervasive and very successful. even to the point where we're beyond just simple microcredit schemes. We're really looking at some of the major energy suppliers talking about off-grid. One of the challenges, though, of course, is you end up with a proliferation of batteries, maybe old kind of batteries. And, you know, one of the duty of care I think we would have here in UN Environment is to keep this one under watch, because it's fantastic to have electricity in many of these rural communities at an affordable price. It is just life-changing. And I see it myself. I mean, it is quite phenomenal how one light in a house transforms even people's perspective of what they can then take on. I think, you know, one should not underestimate this. But we should also be very clear that, you know, this requires oversight. It requires us to think about the disposal of batteries, the disposal of all the kinds of the things that go along with this. Nevertheless, when I'm asked in the fossil fuel debates, are coal, is gas the transition fuel to get us to the 2-degree or the 1.5-degree trajectory and transition pathway? I have to say, no, do not sweat those assets, because the price of solar, and we see it now because of the demand of off-grid solar, is growing so rapidly and the costs are falling. You know, you really have to take on board that this is now the cheapest form of electricity. Whether or not it can be pervasive enough to provide baseload is a question in point, and it needs to be considered within green growth. But I think what we're saying in the chapter, and on the basis of how sales are rising and costs are falling, that we've gone long before that, we've gone long beyond the transition point of cost. This is now can and how do we manage this as a resource to be looked after and to be sustained. Next slide, please. Oh, that was just the distribution, please, next slide. And I'll end up then with the chapter on nano. I call it Nano X because in the natural world, we are actually surrounded by nanomaterials. This is not something that was just invented in the laboratories of advanced science institutes. Quite the opposite. We have nanomaterials that are, in a way, the infrastructure of our whole carbon economy. And it's fascinating when you consider how much, and we've seen this in the context of biomimicry, how much we can rely on nanomaterials to deliver performance again and again and again. An insect takes off, its wings operate, and it operates at levels of flexibility that go beyond anything that we have invented. You think about a lot of the microalgae and the phytoplankton and the corals and many, many other structures, and they already have lots and lots of the characteristics of things that we're looking for in new materials as we go forward in the green economy. However, what science has done is to concentrate our attention into a couple of areas, and one is in nanotubes, carbon nanotubes, and I've chosen to highlight this, not least of which because in the science fiction world, some of you may have read about the space ladder between planet Earth and the space station being built out of carbon nanotubes. And why is that? Well, because carbon nanotubes, as they exist in nature and are now being manufactured, are the strongest and yet most flexible material that has ever been invented. So, what do we know about it? And here is what the chapter points to. It points to the fact that alongside of the excitement of the technology, rolling out a new material with these phenomenal properties, because you simply can slightly alter the chemical composition and it can become a battery. It can have the best optic capabilities. It can have the best electrochemical properties. So these nanotubes are in a way the skeleton of many things that we can build in the future. But going through the literature and talking to a lot of the laboratories that are testing these now, the underbelly of it is that they look uncannily like asbestos. They don't have the same take-up in the organic world as asbestos, but they're pointy, sharp, and tiny. They are essentially like human hairs divided down by thousands two orders of magnitude. So they can penetrate into organic material. They can be taken up by cells, not in the same way as asbestos, but as a physical phenomenon. So what we see is some rising evidence of problems such as breathing disorders. Worryingly, there's evidence that when small mammals are exposed during gestation, that there's a high level of abortion of fetuses. So there's a whole range of what I would call low signaling coming in, that this material, if to become pervasive and to maybe get out into the environment beyond the naturally occurring forms, is something that we must pay attention to. And so I see the final chapter of Frontiers as leaving on the table the, you know, the well-known and well-trodden path of precaution. When do we have enough knowledge to think that we should do something or to intervene? Or can we be smart enough this time around to say, well, we learnt about asbestos. It took us 100 years to put legislation in place. We learnt from mercury. It took us 50 years to put legislation in place. Could we learn this time around that the early signals are worth us paying attention to, not to stop its use, but to understand how it needs to be used in more controlled settings? And I think that's really the point of the Frontiers report, is not to say, you know, to wave the flag and say, well, you know, these are coming, worry. No, it's to say, take action, and these are the places where and how we think you might want to consider taking early action and not waiting too long and having late lessons and essentially having to do a cleanup long after the problems have actually been exposed. So I hope that you will enjoy reading it. I'm happy to answer questions. Our plan right now then is to have it launched mid-June, simply because of scheduling and everything else. We think that's a reasonable time. But of course, for those of you who are interested, there will be sort of pre-release versions. And of course, we would welcome any support to have Frontiers translated, because I think it's one of those, we'll have a summary that we'll be translating, but I think it requires to have a lot of attention around the world, reaching out to citizens as well. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jackie, for a very comprehensive and very interesting presentations as usual. Now I would like to open the floor for any comments, interventions. Colombia, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Jackie, for this very complete presentation on the UN Environment Frontiers. We welcome, Colombia welcome this report and welcome also the information that is stated there. In regard to marine protected areas, it would be quite interesting to get more in-depth information on how we are reaching to the numbers that we have there, and what are the criteria that are we using to define who have good governance and who's not, and definitely also congratulate the countries that have been working very hard to increase the number of protection of the marine environment. This has been really positive. We need to work harder, and that's definitely a goal for the coming years. And it would be also very interesting to look at what are other external factors that are impacting on governance? Because I know that, for instance, in our case, and for the Seafloor Marine Protected Area, which is the largest MPA in the Caribbean, we had a very participatory process. We had a very nice governance structure, but externalities impacted on I would say the future vision of the MPA, and it would be quite interesting to look at those also, because you can have a community that are engaged and that are working very hard, and you have your alternative livelihood set up, you have your monitoring scheme set up, and you have your management plan, and everything is running really, really well. And then there can be like like an international legal decision that jeopardize all what internally you are doing. So it's very important to look at those aspects also and to see how we can deal with them and don't demoralize processes that have a very good hopes to succeed. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ambassador. Pakistan.
Thank you, Madam. And a bigger thank you to the Director of Science Division. Is this a new title? Okay, good. Well, it's a very tantalizing kind of a thing that you have presented, and several questions spring to mind. Now, a concern that one keeps on expressing, but somehow it doesn't really get traction, because there's too much paper flying around. And my concern basically is that, like when you say, you're stating a problem, antimicrobial resistance, and this is not something new. People have been acutely aware of the possibilities. Like if tuberculosis were to make a comeback, or smallpox or something like that, something that doesn't respond to treatment. Basically, we are all done in, The skeptics say maybe it's the great cleansing process maybe, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to go there. But essentially, when you say these things, do you have any, linkage with the World Health Organization or other relevant people? And I think it's important to let people know that. But more importantly, because you're saying more study is needed. Obviously, more study means more money, which you won't get, or which will be hard to find. And then, who is in the lead role? Whether it will be the Director of Science Division or whether it will be someone from WHO or whatever. So while this is happening, I think it would be useful to let, the less well-endowed among us, that okay, this is happening and this is the problem, like you've hinted that in some countries it's pretty visible. And okay, this is something we have prepared. So meanwhile, while the HLPF and UN Environment and everybody is finding their niche in the whole thing, this is something that you can readily do. Because obviously, as we speak, this thing is developing. And basically the same applies to other. I don't want to get into a long-winded, dissection of every section. But it's a very divine kind of a subheading that you have, subduing sand and dust storm. It presupposes a lot of power that human beings have, which probably is not there. So what can we do in the meantime? This is, obviously we can't, turn the entire sort of sand of Sahara into something, more usable. So that is just, I just want to flag this point. Obviously, it's it will be unfair to demand an answer. But I think we need to work in that direction. And then when you say, for example, solar cost is becoming, falling. Now, we don't make any mention of, let's say, wind power. Because to generate the electricity equivalent to a small coal plant, you need almost 200 square miles of, if I'm not exaggerating, of land where you can have, the windmills. So how do you, every country doesn't have that, luxury. So should we also work on cleaning up coal meanwhile? Assuming that at some stage maybe the whole thing will collapse. It's possible. Or you might find an adverse effect of batteries that you're not right now aware of. So, to ensure a better buy-in, I'm sorry this is turning into a speech, but kind of, the buy-in, which is constant from the biggest advocates to the skeptics and then to the, people who basically have no clue. Thank you.
Thank you, Pakistan. U.S.?
Thank you. Thank you for this illuminating presentation. One thing struck me with the discussion, and that was the need for early action for a lot of these items. And I guess that's one of these questions that the United States considers often as we're thinking of what issues to conquer, at, for example, the next UNEA. There are scientists in the United States within the U.S. government that want to explore certain issues, but then the political side says, well, this is a challenge because the scientific understanding is just emerging. Some of these issues are, quite frankly, invisible at first, and it's the scientists who see it first, and until it becomes visible and well understood by a broader community, it still remains difficult to find consensus for a way forward. So I think that's something we really have to focus on, trying to close that gap at UNEP, to try to bridge the gap from identifying these items and then finding a way to quick political consensus. I think if the understanding were truly there among ministers around the world, it would be easy to get that consensus. But we go through this process of discovery and then awareness building and education before we can get to the consensus phase. So I'm just wondering what are the ways we could look at potentially speeding up that process. And then the second point was, I certainly see a few connections myself here, but I'm just wondering what your observations are on connecting it to the pollution theme at UNEA 3, the items that come out of this. Thank you.
Thank you, US. EU.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much to Jackie for this presentation, but also to Oli for the previous one. But let me start from sincerely congratulating you on this project of the reports, the previous year's success, and also this one. This is to say that it's really fulfilling the mandate of UNEP of keeping environment under review, and on this part, on identifying emerging issues and then identifying the gaps in knowledge, gaps in solutions, gaps in regulation, gaps in finance, it's something that we really give mandate to UNEP to deliver on. A question, perhaps an open question, is about the choice of the issues we want to address. I think the feedbacks I have received on the choice for this current report were absolutely positive, so I think the choice is very good. However, we all know that there is a much larger number of emerging issues, and how to find a balance between issues that we want to address now and we can put on hold without losing the momentum and without actually going deeper in the risk of not taking any action. So that is just a very short reaction. Obviously, we would be very interested to see the report as soon as possible, and if the unedited version you refer to is available, we'll be very, very keen to receive it, if possible. Thank you very much.
Thank you, EU. Norway?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the very informative presentation. Of course, Norway, we welcome the Frontiers report, which lifts emerging issues, and like our EU colleague was saying, we find it being one of the central roles of UNEP and one of your main strengths. So the Frontiers 2017 is an important product to inform policy development, like the previous reports. And we find it very positive that it is being published in good time before UNEA 3, which will give us time to digest the information and see what kind of action is needed. And we welcome having an edited version ready, but also any communication information that you would have available beforehand and that you can share with us so we can also share the report when it's being shared officially. Now turning to the antimicrobial resistance issue, and in addition to being a health problem, we see that it is an important signal that it is also an increasing environmental problem, and we look forward to the results of the report in this regard. In 2015, the WHO decided on a global action plan on antimicrobial resistance, where you, amongst others, it was acknowledged that it is a knowledge gap on this issue. And the Frontiers report, we find, will be an important contribution in this regard. Now, seeing that it is in a very clear environment component around this issue, and acknowledgement also that the antimicrobial resistance is a type of a pollution. In the degree that UNEA is the Environment Minister's forum to set focus on emerging issues and important environment challenges, it should be thought about how the UNEA as a forum can contribute to lift this issue also. And lastly, we look forward to see how, or to hear, like our Pakistani colleague has also raised, how UNEP is working with the WHO, FAO, and also the World's Animal Health Organization on this field. Thank you.
Thank you, Norway. Botswana.
Thank you, Chair. Obviously, thanking Jackie. It is not always easy when some things can sound very scientific, trying to simplify them, but I think you've done your best. Very informative. Clearly, if you want to consider this as work in progress, these emerging issues, borrowing the lead from the contribution of Pakistan, the region where we are based and come from, moving away, and the world in general, from reliance on coal. And therefore, I think an opportunity can also be found in how to utilize what emerges from the technologies that may be applied to clean up the coal. There has been talk of green coal technologies, cool earth initiatives, thinking of Japan in this respect, which was funding a very important initiative in that regard. I believe it's an area that we need not forget, that as much as it's something we want to banish to the past as perhaps dangerous, there are also opportunities. I thought that would be very important. I also agree with Colombia. I think she raised a very important question of the criteria, but if we talk about the criteria, it should actually open the opportunity for us to make more input into other frontiers that may be put in the debate as we move forward. Clearly very enlightening, informative, and presented in a very simple manner by a top-notch scientist. Thank you.
Thank you. I agree. If there are no other interventions, I will give the floor to Jackie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the compliments, which I will absolutely pass directly on to Pinya, who's unfortunately going to be left holding it when I leave. So she'll be having to do all the final heavy edits and so forth. But let me come back to some of the potential questions and some answers. My thinking, particularly around marine protected areas, is that just as we've tried to say, the management is the kind of piece you see, and the governance is really where action happens. I think what's been missing in the past is very quick feedback to both parties, in a sense, to the global and to the local, about what marine protected areas really deliver. We've had a preoccupation about cost-benefit. It takes a little while to collect those kinds of data in terms of fisheries, but what we have not been good enough at is really turning around issues around livelihoods and just the general sense in which you've got greater health prospects because of food and so forth. So it's not just about tourism, it's not just about fisheries productivity, it's about the whole ecosystem. And I think that the Sustainable Development Goal development under Goal 14 is really needs to be pushed in that direction, that we can't wait to have statistics and information to make these kinds of governance decisions. And with, to be honest, with our discussion around the resolution on global governance and the discussions in New York, we need to come with much more practical ways of measuring local livelihood improvements over shorter timescales. So I think, you know, there's a lot of creativity that's needed, but I think quick feedback is the way to offset the kind of top-down, you know, sidestepping of some of the issues. If I move on to generally speaking around the antimicrobial resistance, we are of course a core partner and member of the Global Action Plan, the platform that's been set up as a commission. Elliot Harris represents us on that in New York. Of course it has the World Health Organization, but it has our colleagues from the livestock side, Food and Agriculture Organization, the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research. They're all members and party to that movement. But, and I'll be very honest, we're the only ones flying the flag for the environment. Everybody is preoccupied with humans and maybe livestock as well. So, you know, we're waving the flag for the things that eat the bacteria, the soil bacteria that aren't, you know, we don't want them diverted into becoming antibiotic or having resistance. So it's very, very important that when you're having conversations, for example, with colleagues back in the capitals, that you remember that it is the lost soul out there. And yes, of course, we worry about hospitals and we worry about, you know, what you're given when you go to see your doctor. But we need to make the case. Now, Sweden actually has a very innovative approach that could be replicated, and it's called the Green Pharmacopoeia. Every single doctor in Sweden has a book, and it's also tied to green chemistry and green pharmaceuticals, in which it says, if you have a patient with this particular problem, here's the what I would call the standard drug, and here's the environmentally friendly drug that we would rather you use. And wherever possible, please use that one, not the other one. And it's slightly prescriptive. I take my hat off to Sweden being very proactive in this way. But it has already had an impact. So we see, first of all, less antibiotics being prescribed. But more importantly, we see that the dosage and the type and the pervasiveness also being reduced. So we, on a number of occasions, have suggested that that action, that activity, could be extended around the world because these are generic drugs, they have generic capabilities, and they then get given brand names, you know, in different parts of the world. So there are some good practices that we could already instill. So it's awareness, it's telling the general public that this is affecting your water, and actually you're actually re-ingesting somebody else's antibiotics, quite honestly, and on many occasions. Not a very nice thought. So it's awareness, but there are some very practical things that we can do upstream. The consensus amongst science is that it's already out of the bag. Too many of our soil microbial communities are impacted, and there is already transversal genetic movement of all the major fragments of antibiotic resistance. So, you know, it is out there. One thing, though, and I will then take my hat off to the traditional medicine community, there are many plants that are able in the wild to fight off this antibiotic process. And we know that there are several active molecules here in Africa and other places, which again need to be sort of brought into the laboratory. But learning the lessons, the early action, we should be very careful how those then get used and taken up into the pharmaceutical industry so as not to repeat the mistakes of the past. So there's a whole kind of industrial conversation that has to go on about how we bring novel molecules into the pharmaceutical process and how they're then dispersed into the human population. On solar and wind, I mean, of course, I take your point. I think we wanted to highlight this issue of the underbelly of the big infrastructure renewable energy that's going on, where it's the 40 million, the billions and billions of investment, and yet we see small households finding the wherewithal to buy small solar packs to actually change their access to electricity. What I like is the novelty, for example, here, where you have M-Pesa and M-Copa joining forces together so that M-Pesa drops the charge for when someone pays their M-Copa bill. So these small initiatives actually are what's driving a lot of very localized spread for solar. And that's why I think solar will always be the choice of source of energy when it comes to small households. It's very difficult to talk about having wind turbines when you haven't even got beyond the case of $10, whereas you can afford solar now at that kind of pricing. It really is. Can I use this last moment to speak to you all? Please, if you have any influence over coal, leave it in the ground. Don't sweat the asset. I can give you so many arguments as to why, you know, we shouldn't be doing it, even if it's the resource at your fingertips. And it's so, you know, it's so tantalizing to think, let's just take it out and use it for the next 5 years. You will price your way out of the energy market. This is the sad fact. You know, I could have the conversation with Poland. I can have the conversation with many of the Stans. Those are countries who are sitting on coal that could take them to the end of the century. But frankly, the price of renewables is such that it is now competitive. And we have to get those numbers out into the marketplace so that people understand. And you get a far greater breadth of investors. So I'm very happy to say that in the emissions gap report, we will look at coal. We will have that as part of our report. And there will be the upside and the downside in terms of the emissions gap, but also what it looks like to have full-on coal as a transition and gas, and to do without. And I can tell you it's day and night. You have a chance of 2 degrees if you go down that route with renewables. You do not have a chance if all the assets sitting there as coal are turned on. And already we see that many companies are turning away. Australia, for example, and others are experiencing that top companies are walking away from the continuation of this biggest coal mine that we have, because they see it's reputationally difficult now to sustain a profile which is driven by coal. So that's my own kind of take on it, but you'll see the numbers in the emissions gap report coming through, so I hope that they'll be convincing for you. Sand and dust storms. Yes, maybe it's a bit presumptive to talk about subduing, but in a way it's about locally trying to do something and giving hope to many parts of the world that it is good land management that will take you there. But it's got to be land management on a large scale. It can't be just a few trees here and there. It's got to actually be good practices of use of water, land cover, and so forth. But, you know, I think I stand by the fact that we need to do practical things, and this points to some of those. Finally, then, to the US and to others who've talked about the timing of this and where it sits in regard to UNEA, I think it's important that maybe you find a slot somehow in the discussions in the Environment Assembly regularly to take on the kind of emerging issues. Even to say that you won't do something in each UNEA relating to that topic, but to set the scene for 2 years down the line. So maybe in 2 years' time, you have joint fact-finding that comes back and says, now we really understand what we could do. So maybe it's more that kind of rollover. But early action is without a doubt possible on a lot of the pollutants. And the reason why I think nanomaterials should at least appear somewhere is because they are just taking off. And you can see that there's so much potential there. So this is one of those moments where you can look very wise and look back and say, we actually considered nano and we thought about it very seriously. We think about all the benefits of it, but we don't want to repeat an asbestos disaster. So we're going to do it carefully with all the chemicals management tools that we've got, and we can actually generate a future where we use these materials to good purpose without having the environmental tail behind it. I think, Madam Chair, that's really it. Thank you. And thank you for all your questions.
Thank you very much. If there is no other intervention, I must state that this is a very timely report, and I appreciate all the interventions also on the linkage with the next Environmental Assembly. Yes, emerging issues, I think it will be on the table in a way or another. In resolution or discussion, it will be on the table of the next Assembly. And because it's your last one, allow me to thank you on behalf of everybody for the very simple language, as my colleague from Botswana said, explaining science and making environmental scientific data available for people who are not scientists. And I would like to wish you all very best. I hope that you will be able to stay longer in other capacity and to assist UNEA, but if it's not possible, we wish you the very best and see you somewhere else then. And let's applaud her. Thank you. So we concluded agenda item 3. And we arrived to number 4. It's an update on international environmental governance. It's about progress made since Rio Plus 20 conference and proposes a way forward in order to strengthen the role of environmental governance and especially of UN Environmental Assembly. And I would like to invite the Law Division to make a presentation. Elizabeth, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you also, distinguished delegates in the room. As Madam Chair has indicated, my intention is basically to give an update of our work on international environmental governance. And we are saying update because you recall we also had a progress report or update beginning of the year or towards the end of last year. So it's taking up from there. Just to remind ourselves, our work on international environmental governance is basically looking at how are we faring with regards to the implementation of paragraph 88 and in part also 89 of the Future We Want document, which was adopted as the outcome document of the Rio Plus 20. And there are many issues under that aspect, but here I will focus on trying to respond in terms of progress, not that the answers are already in place. How are we faring after the Rio Plus 20, almost getting into 5 years thereafter? And how are we engaging? And when I say we here, I mean the UN environment as well as our governing body, the UN Environment Assembly. And this is with regards to then engagement with the high-level political forum, our contribution to the Sustainable Development Goals, and also now if we look specifically, part of the outcome of paragraph 88 is our universal governing body from the 58 member state governing body at the time. Next. Paragraph 88 is the one which basically strengthened and upgraded the role of UN environment, one in terms of its universal membership of its governing body. It also talked of secure, stable, adequate, increased financial resources. Not that we have reached there yet, but it's there. Enhanced coordination functions within the UN system, and this is particularly our work through the Environmental Management Group. The strong science policy interface, and this is basically the work which Jackie and the team have been doing, and we just had one specific example of that. And currently, actually, we are also looking at science governance policy, a document which will be shared with you later in due course. We are still in the draft form in terms of looking at the nexus between science, policy, and governance. Equally, again, through the work of our science division, Jackie and the team, is the evidence-based environmental information, and all the brief previous, including today, is in response to that aspect. Our work across the organization in terms of capacity building and access to technology responds to this. And of course, there is the issue of consolidation of the headquarters functions in Nairobi and stronger regional presence and active participation of our stakeholders. Next. In terms of whether or not our UN environment and UN Environmental Assembly is fit for purpose in response to paragraph 88 and 89, and also with your input here today and before and after, is to try to respond to these questions. One is whether the strengthened UN environment is actually meeting up to the expectations of the leaders leading to the paragraph 88 decision, whether the UN Environment Assembly is also adequate, raising the high political awareness, political feasibility in terms of our today's environmental challenges and solutions. And lastly, is how then we can have the UN Environment and Environment Assembly becoming the driving force in terms of ensuring effective international environmental governance. In that respect, what we have done since last year, and this is where the progress comes in, last year we had already updated you or briefed you on the high-level dialogue we had in terms of achieving environmental sustainability for sustainable development, an event which we had during the high-level political forum last year in July with the presence of our president of the assembly. It was followed back-to-back with an expert workshop, again looking at environmental sustainability issues for sustainable development, again with the presence of the president of our assembly, as well as our chair of the Committee of Permanent Representative here, Madam Pataki. In December, we had an open discussion here with Professor Maria Ivanova, who also actually co-chaired this expert workshop in July, and her herself being an expert, a global expert on international environmental governance issues in terms of sharing the outcomes of the expert workshop, but also generally how should we be looking at issues related to environmental governance and in response to also the Agenda 2030, Agenda for Sustainable Development. The government of Switzerland is taking further that discussion through a workshop it is organizing to take place later next month. And Madam Chair, with your permission, I will appreciate if we can permit our distinguished representative from Switzerland, Florian, to update us of the intention and what is planned through this workshop, which we'll further discuss, look again at the progress from the previous discussions, and of course, looking at issues moving forward. We are looking and proposing having, again, another event during the high-level political forum in July, but we are still waiting for feedback because we've just submitted the request and waiting for now confirmation whether it will be approved. So as the result of these few events which I've just mentioned, basically then what is coming up as some of the ideas in terms of caring, strengthening environmental governance. One is looking at our many resolutions adopted by the Assembly. You recall, distinguished delegates here, when we're looking at the postmortem of UNEA 2, there was that concern which was raised in terms of looking in future, streamlining and reducing the number of resolutions. But the ones already adopted, we have to implement and execute them, but can you help us to prioritize them, considering or taking into account also the resources needed to implement all the 25 resolutions? And of course, here we are not forgetting the previous governing bodies, resolutions adopted by the governing body. And we hope also in terms of prioritization, this is where we like also not to forget working with not just ministries or departments of environment at national level, but engaging other bodies like regional economic commissions, other UN entities, because all these feed into the discussions of sustainable development at the high-level political forum. We need also to identify environmental nexus issues which bring then development gains in other areas. The links between environment and health, food security. We just had issues related to environment and humanitarian emergency action and the like. There also are proposals looking at how do we enhance the interface between the UN Environment Assembly and the environmental treaties or outcomes of the governing bodies from the environmental treaties. And here we need to consider, we have also paragraph 89 of the Future We Want outcome document, which specifically addresses coherence, coordination, avoidance of duplication, synergies issues among the multilateral environmental agreements. Other issues was also with regard proposal in terms of enhancing and uplifting the political feasibility of the Environment Assembly, whether there could be a way to consider the sessions of the Assembly, a possibility of having it in other geographical locations, because that then also permits the countries hosting such an Assembly to really work towards creating that political feasibility and engagement of other stakeholders in such discussion. Again, that was a proposal. Another was regards to playing a more meaningful, active role on environment norm setter within the UN system. And this is the entire work currently also going on through the Environmental Management Group. Issues related now to the membership. With the Environment Assembly, membership is universal, 193 UN member states, but our Committee of Permanent Representatives, 118 members. So how do we align that membership and power to be able to further enhance communication between and engagement between the two bodies? Finally, key is the need and the importance to finalize our new stakeholder engagement policy. We know the global trend now is the importance and engagement of stakeholders in all our work in environmental issues. We know the key role they play, but we need to know how to engage them and engage with them. And this is the essence of completion of the stakeholder engagement policy, which we need. In terms of then moving forward and what here we'll request to get your feedback, one is our intention to continue to interact with member states as well as the stakeholders in terms of positioning better the governance questions for environmental sustainability, environmental and sustainable development, and to further also strengthen the role of regional environmental ministerial processes, fora, also the multilateral environmental agreements, as well as other entities. And therefore, your views in terms of how do we move forward to further reinforce the role of UN environment, UN Environmental Assembly as key player in international environmental governance will be appreciated. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. For you to be very clear on this process, it was started last year by UNEP. As you know, as you understood, the key question here is what kind of governing bodies we would like to see. Are we achieving, did we achieve what we intended to do? This conversation is going on in preparation for the next assembly. The visibility and the strength of the assembly is essential. And the question is how we can continue this process, how we can continue Switzerland graciously offered to host another discussion. But my quick question is, how can we take the discussion to Nairobi, also on the CPR level, because this is basically a member state driven process. Of course, stakeholders' presence and opinion is essential, but we have to continue also discussion here. So now, if you allow me, first I would like to give the floor to Switzerland to give us more details on the workshop organized in June. And after that, I will open the floor for any other comments or intervention questions. Switzerland, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks to the Secretariat for, first of all, this updated briefing note and the presentation we just saw. We think it's really a good moment to renew the discussions on the topic of international environmental governance and to assess where we stand 5 years after Rio plus 20. We very much welcome all the initiatives that have been taken so far by UNEP, and we saw this impressive list of events that have already taken place last year. Now, we want to give member states an opportunity to carry on with this discussion at the workshop on international environment governments, and as it has been said, it will take place in Glion in Switzerland from 20th to 22nd of June. The objective of the workshop is mainly to identify the most important areas of attention and issues in international environmental governance, and then to follow up and to develop and to evaluate options to move forward these very issues in supporting international environmental governance. Maybe a bit more specifically, we are looking at opportunities for unlocking the potential of UNEP and the Environment Assembly and the multilateral environmental agreements, how to overcome governance hurdles. And finally, the meeting also wants to develop and to evaluate options for integrating and implementing the environmental dimension of the sustainable development goals. Maybe I should mention that this workshop is, and it has been said, is member states driven. The process should be member states driven. So that's why we stepped forward and offered to host this workshop. The workshop will bring together government delegates from all regions of the world. But also UNEP will be present, and multilateral environmental agreement secretariats will also be there during the workshop. The intention is that the outcomes, the results of the discussions, they will feed into the discussion on the international environmental governance, notably also the Environmental Assembly of this year. So these results, they shall be brought back to the member states and then to be used in our subsequent discussions on this issue. I think that's all I have to say for the moment. And thank you again for the opportunity to present this workshop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm opening the floor for comments. I see Pakistan.
Thank you, Madam. Well, the future we want was in 2012. The event you had was in 2016. And after that, what we have are what you yourself characterize as thought starters. Now, what has been happening in these 5 years? You know, why did it take so long? Are we to say that what found its way into the Future We Want document, was it not very well thought out? If so, why are we still just starting thoughts? And even the event we are going to have in Switzerland will invite thoughts and, you know, more thinking. And so what is your what is the UN environment's take on it? in an understandable form, that are there any hurdles? Do you think it was a mistake for the HLPF to have, let's say, the overarching role? Is the fact that everyone is not represented in Nairobi a hurdle? You know, what exactly? So that, you know, things can be moved ahead. And then also, if you permit me, about these other environmental agreements, is there any traction, like in the sense that have you found any common ground with them in your discussions with them? Are they really looking upon UNEP to be the Pied Piper, as we have just seen in that very inspiring, painting by, I'm sure, a very good artist? So do they really want that, or do you just want to kind of impose yourself on them while they themselves are not very sure? I mean, the reason why I'm asking is that if we here at the UNEP are not very sure, where do we fit in the larger scheme of things? And even the inputs, I mean, we have seen that document. It's a well-intentioned document, the input that you want to give to the HLPF. But the input cannot always be aspirational. You know, I mean, the HLPF, as the name presupposes, is composed of very busy people. So you need to give them something very pithy that they can just, you know, understand and then implement. The conversation at some point has to end and action has to start. That's the basic point. Thank you.
Thank you, Pakistan. Any other EU? And after that, Botswana.
I'm sorry, I think Botswana was before me.
Well, the nominated chair, future chair of CPR, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You are embarrassing me.
No, I don't.
I think, as I like the intellectual approach, very pertinent questions that have been raised by my friend from Pakistan. Indeed, there are pertinent issues that one could apply their minds to, at least. But I also see this process, indeed, as part of the ways in which, as captured here, we can meaningfully position UNEP and UNEA, yes, to position itself to contribute effectively after the adoption of Agenda 2030. And therefore, the linkage to 2012 must also be contextualized from 2015 going forwards. And therefore, it is a very useful process. What has taken place in New York in 2016, in July, which provided these thought starters, is a good process. I would like to take these as just thoughts, which Elizabeth has updated, which obviously would continue to be informed by the workshop that Switzerland is also hosting. I know that perhaps in the earlier thoughts, maybe there was not wide enough representation, particularly from Nairobi, to ensure that when we talk about consolidation of headquarters functions, we don't find ourselves undermining that with other thoughts that appear contrary to that very noble objective. When you look, I don't want to go through these thought starters, because as I say, they are really thoughts. But when you look at the nexus, environment nexus, I see a very glaring absence, for instance, of nexus between poverty and environment, because clearly when we want to advance the social development side of things, poverty or poverty eradication, as some refer to, is really at the heart of that. And therefore, I really think let's build on this, but let's also be conscious of the decisions that we have taken and that we don't depart from the undertaking of Rio Plus 20 in certain respects, particularly the point of consolidation of headquarters functions. If I was to be bold, I would say the idea of holding United Nations Environment Assembly at other regions may not help consolidate these headquarters functions. Indeed, when we, it is like, let's hold United Nations General Assembly in another capital, because this is now globalized. But as I say, these are just initial thoughts. Obviously, we can continue to exchange views and build on these in the next series of interactions, starting with Switzerland. Thank you.
Thank you, Botswana. Just very quickly, holding assembly meetings in other locations is not possible according to the rules of procedures. And our friend Stedler, who's not anymore here, can confirm that. So that's off the table for now. I give the floor to EU.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for bringing this issue and this process to the attention and actually even awareness of the CPR, I would say, finally, because this process may look, I think, at least to some, a little bit unclear. First question is perhaps, what is the sense of gravity for this process? Is it New York and HLPF, because we had a workshop there last year? Is it Nairobi and Tunea, as we've heard that there might be some outcomes of this discussion submitted to UNEA. I think also I feel somewhat underinformed about the different outcomes of the steps. Apologies if that was made public, but I haven't seen a briefing from the New York workshop nor from the Planet Unplugged meeting in December last year. So I think there is something we certainly need to improve. This being said, the questions are absolutely pertinent, and I think this Rio Plus 20 Plus 5 is a good moment to actually have that discussion. And I would like to thank the government of Switzerland for taking the initiative of organizing and hosting the meeting. Yet I think we still need to clarify on what are the linkages of that meeting with the process. The official process in Nairobi and the preparations for UNEA, and what is the participation that we would all consider relevant and representative for this process to ensure good contributions to our discussion. I would have also a question about what is the envisaged outcome of this process. The distinguished representative of Switzerland said that the outcome could contribute to the UNEA 3. I think we should have this sort of discussion. What are we planning to discuss in UNEA 3? I'm not saying that this should not take place. Maybe actually it should, but given that there are some dates that are actually encouraging to have that sort of reflection, but we haven't had that discussion yet in Nairobi, and I think we urgently should. If we clarify on what are our objectives for possible discussion in UNEA, what would be the conclusions of this five years after review, and I think some ideas put on the table by Elizabeth in her presentations are very valid and quite guiding. Perhaps we could also, and that's a side remark, include among the practical discussions and conclusions also the name of the organization, because I must say that was quite confusing to see in the document three different names of this organization, and that might be a good opportunity to also take a position on that and have a common understanding amongst the member states. That discussion I didn't mention, but it's also important to keep in mind any possible discussion on the governance of United Nations Environment Programme in the context of the reform of the UN system, and what linkages we see with that process. And my last point is a question about practical plans of UNEP in relation to this year's high-level political forum, if we could hear if you are planning a side event or what could be the subject and how we are progressing on the preparations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You, Pakistan.
Thank you, Madam. So basically, we have the pertinent questions. We have the upcoming discussion in Switzerland. And then where do we go from there? I mean, should we then aspire for, let's say, a GA resolution, which would be kind of odd since UNEA 3 is coming up? Or should we work on a UNEA 3 resolution with something more concrete based on the thoughts so that it does not become a perennial process? You see, Rio plus 5 and then plus 5 and the plus 5 will go on. So to have like some sort of a cutoff point, and then again, I mean, I leave it to your, able judgment, perhaps in consultation with the legal advisor, as to what would be the status of that resolution vis-a-vis the General Assembly. So should we then try to validate it by the General Assembly or something? But that's a larger question. The issue basically is that whatever thoughts we have, whatever lacuna has been identified, have been identified, then should we put that in some sort of a form that helps us move forward, or are we going to just go on talking? I mean, that's a central question. And on that, I would urge all of us, taking advantage of whichever countries are represented here, to do something concrete in this regard, which can bring about some change. How do we, of course, these questions will have to be addressed. HLPF, what is the extent of what the UNEP can do, UNEP or UN environment, how far can the ED go, whatever, what is the relationship between CPR Bureau and UNEA Bureau and so on and so forth. So I think these questions will need to be addressed if we want to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to remind all of us that we already agreed that resolutions are linked to the pollution team for this particular assembly. But I have some ideas, so at the end, when the discussions are... And really, apologies to Kenya. I will give you the floor. I missed you, so please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kenya is thanking Elizabeth and the team for the good presentation. We concur with Pakistan on the initial comments and Botswana on the issues, on the pertinent issues that they've raised. We particularly take note of the suggestions on moving forward, and we believe that the real spirit and the real principles on consolidation of headquarter functions and strengthening of the regional presence is key to achieving UNEA feasibility and effectiveness. We particularly concerned about the suggestion on the venue on future UNEAs, although the chair has already clarified, and the issue that we wanted to raise is that we believe that changing or holding UNEA in other venues will undermine the Rio Plus 20 spirit and principle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kenya. Again, that was one of the issues raised during the discussions last year. It is just an issue, but according to the rules of procedure, that is not possible without amending the rules of procedures, if I'm correct, isn't it? So I give now the floor to France.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I would like, as my predecessor, thank Elizabeth and what we heard, thanks to the presentation, but also I try to be in line with what the EU delegate mentioned before. If I ask for the floor, I think that there is something missing in our discussion, and I would like perhaps to point that out now. The world has changed. Without coming back on the question of the UN reform in discussion in New York, I think that in order, as Sebastian raised, about what are we expecting as the outcome of this discussion, perhaps it could help us to think that what UNEA and UNEP could bring to the new Secretary General and what he announced as a change in dealing with his new plan about peace, security, sustainable development and human rights. And if we try not only to focus on how to increase the effectiveness or the visibility of UNEA and to discuss among us on something which is completely closed a world for me, but if we would change, on the contrary, how to use UNEA as we succeeding in getting after two sessions and for UNEA 3, and seeing what could be the added value of UNEA and UNEP in the new plan of the Secretary General, perhaps it would help us to go in a direction which would be a sort of update, as Sebastian said, that it could be a review of Rio plus 20 plus 5, and to check what would be exactly relevant for the aims and the objective of the Secretary General and the Deputy Secretary General. And I haven't heard that until the nomination of the Secretary General. He visited us. He told us that he referred strongly to what we are supposed to do in helping us in his task. But we should perhaps think in that way. And in addition to that, I have a specific question to Elizabeth. We know that there is meetings of EMG regularly. That is discussion among the head of the agencies, UN agencies, and specifically with the pillar of the environment defended by the head of UN UNEP. Would it be possible at a moment to see what is the result of the indication of this discussion in order to help us? Because we can say in workshop or here at the CPR that we would like to work better with the other institution. If the other already addressed that at the EMG, it could help us in thinking how to organize also our collaboration with the other entities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If there are no other comments, I would give the floor to Elizabeth to quickly, as much as possible, to reply.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, distinguished delegates, for all the questions and very useful questions, very useful comments made. Permit me to respond them probably more general, and I will begin with the initial intervention by the distinguished ambassador from Pakistan. Why are we still 5 years talking? We are not yet moving into actions. I think, distinguished delegates, we need to remember that Rio Plus 20 first established the high-level political forum, changing it from the Commission for Sustainable Development. And for the first two sessions of the high-level political forum, was still setting up itself terms of reference, who is who, the priorities, and what have you. It was the meeting before last when the high-level political forum only now was able to have its own timetable. Every 4 years, review in detail progress on the sustainable development goals. This year, it will now begin reviewing the initial first goals, and that's why the priority in July this year will be the goal number 1, 2, 3. Recall the responses we provided with your input to the President of Economic and Social Council. So it's basically now beginning looking at how are we faring in responding to the specific sustainable development goals. And what it has already decided is that each year then will be specific identified goals. So that could be part of that explanation. Second, we also need to remember that the Future We Want document is the one which called for the negotiations of the Sustainable Development Goals and 2030 Agenda, which took 3 years, and only September 2015 when the goals were adopted. 2016, last year, January, was when now the implementation by countries was expected to begin. So basically, we are 1 year into action. I think that also might explain why it took long. So probably after 2 years, by next year, we should be able now, and not just UN environment, but also countries at national level, to actually begin responding concretely, what are we doing, taking action now, operations into action and moving away from speaking. I agree with all the reminder that our rules of procedure are very clear in terms of the venue of the environment assembly, but remember here I was sharing the recommendation, the inputs from the different discussions, not that the UN environment agrees with them. There have been several also questions, where do we move from here or from the workshop in Switzerland? Distinguished delegates, we need to remember there has not yet been formal discussions, negotiations by the member states on this environmental governance. What we have only begun is to, one might say, well, test the ground. So that's why we are still talking of experts' workshop, either in individual capacity. Even Switzerland, and the representative may correct me, it's not a negotiation. Again, experts, both government and other representatives invited, again, to get the ideas. So even whether we want to bring it to UNEA or not, personally, I think it's still premature because there has not been that formal discussion. So if we want to bring the issue now to UNEA, I think we need to take a step back where then the member states have an opportunity to discuss, have their views, hopefully also considering the different recommendations, outcomes from these different experts' workshop side events, which are all ideas, into that discussion so as to have now member states' guidance decision on how to move forward. So up to now, we are not yet there. But if you are telling us now, let's take the next step and move into formal debate, we are on your hands, but not yet so far. And therefore, where do we move from Lyon, Switzerland? I think it's yet still to be determined by you member states. But otherwise, it's still that open discussion of getting out different views on the subject matter. EU, and I want to look at my colleague Mamadou, I thought we had already shared with the member states our report from the New York workshop. If not, our sincere apologies. That report is there. We will have to, we'll do that immediately. But Mamadou will confirm. I thought we had done that. With regards to Unplugged Planet, normally these are just open discussion. We do not prepare report. I will stand to be corrected by my colleague Jorge here, but at least in the past there have not been formal report on that. I think I've responded where we go from here. Kenya, yes, we take your point. France, yes, EMG meetings. Environmental Management Group indeed meet virtually, very regularly. There's even a meeting, I think, next week. 3 weeks ago, there was another meeting looking at the what we call nexus dialogue between environment. That was environment and what? Environment and humanitarian affairs. So EMG, our regular virtual meetings through GoTo meeting and Skype, has been regular based on an issue. For instance, now there's discussion among the UN agencies on e-waste, and that's the plan meeting. The next plan virtual meeting is how are we faring on the system-wide strategies on environments, which member states adopted as one of our resolution last year. So basically, again, taking stock where we are, different agencies, as we prepare ourselves for the next, for our progress report to UNEA. What has also begun now recently is the nexus dialogue between environment and different issues, which are also determined by the group. Probably what we can do for the benefit of the members here and through my colleague Jorge is basically maybe to have a specific updated briefing on the environmental management group work at the future date. Then we can have Elliot and my colleague Hossein in Geneva to give us the more details if that will be agreed. How does our work connect, link with the Secretary General's UN reform? In July, there was the Chief Executive Board meeting, which brings together all heads of the UN different UN agencies entities with the Secretary General, which actually had a long lot discussions between regarding the Secretary General priorities clearly now defined and the planned reforms. We were actually to have, it should have been today, lunch session, a session with Eric, our head here, to begin discussing how then does our work feed, respond, connect, respond to the Secretary General reforms, because the Chief Executive Board meeting was only, I think, 3 weeks ago. So we are now beginning to make that direct connection. So I hope at a future date we should be more concrete on how, as UN Environment, will be responding to this future, I mean, the UN reforms as well as the Secretary General priorities for the UN as a whole. I think Madam Chair can stop there for now, unless otherwise. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Elizabeth. Mamadou, if we had a specific briefing on this workshop or not?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the answer is yes. We did have an outcome document which was produced, and since we had organized this event in collaboration with the European Commission, actually, we did send this briefing out to, you know, to the Commission as well, since the question came from the European Union. And you also, while I have the floor, Madam Chair, just maybe answer what we're planning for this year's HLPF as well. We do have a high-level dialogue planned as well, and the title that we submitted to DESA for now is 5 years from Rio Plus 20, how has environmental governance evolved to sustain the 2030 development agenda? So that's the topic we have for now for high-level dialogue in the margins of the HLPF. And we are waiting to hear from DESA whether this will be one of the events that will be approved in the schedule or not. So only in June, I guess, we will be able to have a clear answer as to whether we're moving forward with this or not. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I see EU and Pakistan. EU.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry for taking the floor again. Just a couple of follow-up issues. I think I'm taking point on the informal nature of this process and also hearing the point of view of Elizabeth that it might be premature to bring it to UNEA 3. But as you can see, there is an interest in the CPR amongst the member states to be fully informed, to be possibly involved as the intersessional body of UNEP. Perhaps as a concrete proposal, a briefing after the meeting in Switzerland would be an appropriate step forward. Perhaps a little bit more than just a briefing based on a small paper, rather to, if well prepared, a little bit more than 1 week in advance with documents that we could digest and discuss with our capitals and actually have a discussion, not only a presentation of the meeting. And just to comment on the report from the New York meeting, I think it's absolutely necessary, and just sharing with the Commission, European Commission, is not enough. I mean, we are talking about the CPR and the full membership that should be fully involved. And maybe just in relation to the proposed meeting in September, building on the outcomes of a meeting in Switzerland, I think we should definitely benefit from more information like it was promised from the EMG discussions, but also in relation to the paragraph 89 and the cooperation with the multilateral environmental agreements, and I think we would look forward to hearing on the progress on the implementation of the resolution of UNEA 2 in this regard. I think this ongoing process is very relevant for the overall picture of the environmental governance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pakistan and Mexico after.
Thank you, Madam. Well, I realize we have a rather crowded agenda, and you know, we are in the year of UNEA 3 and so on and so forth. But I think this is obviously valuable work which should not just get lost. So what I would propose is that after the Switzerland meeting, we get a state of play from the Secretariat. Also, perhaps some charts or something which, you know, show the governance, okay, how do things stand. Frankly, I'm not very clear myself, you know, who does what, and, you know, or who should be doing less and who should be doing more. I think we need some idea of that. And then I think the CPR, or as the case may be, we need to work on something more concrete, that this is what has emerged, and it need not be an immediate resolution which goes to the General Assembly, but then we can keep on discussing it, kind of fine-tuning it. And perhaps by 2018, we might be in a position to table something at the General Assembly, which would basically take care of the procedural and legal issues and, you know, we can't do this or that or whatever, and in order to move forward. Yes, it would be important to have this conversation with, let's say, the Secretary General and other significant actors. That can be done. You know, if they have some concerns or if they think that there is something that they can do better, you know, there should be clarity on that. And again, I mean, this UN reform business, we also need to be seized of that, so that it just does not come, you know, it's not just thrown at us, and then we are scrambling to, you know, save Nairobi as the headquarters or whatever. Thank you.
Thank you, Mexico.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, thank you to the Secretariat for this presentation. Just like the EU, we would be interested in more information on this process. We believe that it's important also to be able to feed back to capital, because there's a lot of things that are they're moving on in this sense. Specifically regarding to the relationship with the HLPF, that is an issue that's of high importance to Mexico. And we see that even though it's something in process, and that the HLPF itself has to devise its ways of working, but it also brings us back to a core responsibility between UNEP Secretariat and the member states on this side, on knowing the exact ways we want to interact as UNEP, UNEA, with the HLPF. So we have stated this before, that we believe that there needs to be a little bit more of an order and clear guidelines on how we need to move forward, because even though there's inputs that are being sent by the president of UNEA, there's also inputs from UNEP itself, and we need to have this a little bit more structured. So we would like to request the Secretariat to come up with some of the ideas that they have thought for restructuring the governance, or any other ideas on how to improve the ways that UNEA and UNEP will interact with the HLPF, because this is something that we can start working on between the Secretariat and member states to improve this, and especially taking into account that once we have reset the cycle for UNEA, it'll be happening every 2 years, but there will be a gap year, and this will also be very important for us to be able to feed in whichever way UNEA is working, and UNEP during that gap year towards the HLPF. Thank you.
Thank you, Mexico, U.S.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation, and thank you to all the member states who have weighed in on this. I think most of the suggestions on a way forward are make a lot of sense, but I did want to reference the one question that Elizabeth had when responding to the High Commissioner to Pakistan regarding whether there were consensus to formally move forward, then we could potentially look at doing that, and I can say that there probably isn't consensus to formally move forward. That doesn't say that the suggestions raised by the EU and by Mexico aren't good ones, and we should continue to discuss this, but looking at this more formally and looking at a concrete solution, I think it's premature to do that. I think we do have to have these more informal discussions after the meeting in Switzerland to kind of find a straightforward way forward that we can get consensus behind. And I'd also just express one concern about linking the UN reform too closely to this discussion, because inherently you're dealing with mandate issues in this discussion. And it's not necessarily, as far as I understand, the reform is focused more on efficiency. So, of course, there is the possibility for identifying efficiencies within this process. But we need to be careful we don't discuss the mandate issues under the guise of efficiency. So thank you.
Thank you very much. If there are none, I would like to just clarify why I have requested this briefing. I have requested for long because I consider that the questions raised informally under Chatham House rules, so no report was done last year, were raised, and some of those questions raised and issues underlined by the participants were raised by Elizabeth in this presentation. I think that one of the most important issue was the raising awareness of the member states on their role in making the assembly more visible and more efficient. And I think that the discussion should come to the intergovernmental body of the assembly. I wasn't thinking about formalizing it. I was thinking more about informal discussions and to find a solution how we move forward. That clearly not exclude other meetings like Switzerland is organizing, because all kind of discussions on the issues that basically are bothering us related to the assembly is very important to be discussed in a larger way, and with all stakeholders, all member states. What I consider really important in these discussions is that, let's say, Nairobi's presence in these discussions, in a way or another, also balanced participation of regional and political groups, because some of the regional political groups, they have very clear opinion about these issues. Including especially Nairobi, in a way or another, in these discussions is essential, because all kind of processes are in the intersessional period are done and conducted in Nairobi. So I am taking on board all comments. What I would like to propose and for the next chair, starting with September, is that, yes, and I'm not kidding, is that after the briefing, what actually was discussed in Switzerland, to have a kind of the law division maybe can work on a kind of how to frame this process and have a proposal. And as U.S. said, to continue discussions informally till we don't have consensus on the shaping of this particular process. Because visibility and efficiency of the assembly, I think, is dear to all of us. So with this, I think that we concluded agenda item 4. And we go to our last substantive agenda item. Is update on the intention of member states to submit resolutions. And that is very dear to us. We had a deadline, which we agreed it was, and thank you very much, I'm sorry, thank you, Elizabeth Mamadou, thank you for your presence. the resolution, we had a deadline for 30th of April, another one 1st of June and 15th of June, to put forward ideas, topics that you consider important and linked to the theme pollution for the next assembly in December this year. I would like to invite the Secretariat to make a short presentation, but before I give the floor to Jorge, to be very clear, the document presented is not resolution proposals, are only ideas put forward by member states or regional political groups to be considered. Another issue, I think that in order to be efficient as we were till this moment, it's essential that all of us agree on what kind of resolution, how many resolutions, the topics we would like to start drafting in July. So that means that ideally, and I would propose this to you, to agree on topics till the end of June, and allowing member states, together with the experts, secretariat of UNEP, to start working on drafting resolution in June, July, and of course negotiate in September. I would also remind you the elements that we agreed on, and you agreed on also, on short, limited number of resolution and all linked to the team pollution. So now I give the floor to Jorge to make a short presentation on this.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My presentation will be indeed very brief. I just would like to remind member states of the agreement that you made during the fourth annual subcommittee, during which you agreed to a timetable for the development and preparations of draft resolutions for consideration of the 2017 Environment Assembly. In that agreement, it is quite well reflected that resolutions have to be linked to the overarching theme of the Assembly, as Madam Chair has already pointed out. Furthermore, you agreed to an initial deadline of 30th of April for member states to share their thoughts, their ideas, their thinking on those areas, specific areas, which you think may merit further discussion. And this is the stage in which we are now. The list that we have prepared for you reflects the contributions that we have thus far received from the parties that are reflected there and highlight one way or another different aspects of the pollution agenda. Just to remind, and before I conclude, the next steps of this discussion, if we are to be guided by the roadmap that you have set forth, are, first of all, our 139th meeting of the Committee of Permanent Representatives, during which we may take up again the agenda item, if you wish, and that's something that has been there in the agenda. And then we have the 140th meeting of the Committee of Permanent Representatives, in which we hope to close this process in October. So, as Madam Chair has indicated, now is your opportunity to see how do you organize yourselves between now and October so as to be able to present a good package of draft proposals for the Assembly to consider and hopefully finalize during the open-ended Committee of Permanent Representatives. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Jorge. I'm opening the floor for any comments. Pakistan.
Thank you. Well, so far the number seems manageable. I would also like to recall a general agreement that we had during the breakfast in Karura Forest that perhaps there should only be one resolution from every regional group. So maybe the EU can give some thought to merging some of its resolutions. Basically, the theme is the same and perhaps but we can have a fuller idea when we have the text. So the specific question is, by when can we hope to get to see the text of the resolution? You know, beyond this paragraph. That's the question. Thank you.
Thank you. I give the floor to Botswana, Mexico, and Brazil after. Botswana.
Thank you, Chair. Simple, concise. The first point is Of course, as you rightly stated, these are ideas. These are not necessarily the final resolutions. And therefore, we welcome at least the early communication of ideas from the groups that have put forth the ideas. Of course, a quick look, you see 10. Somebody may see 10. I see only 4 resolutions there, because there's a lot of scope for consolidation of these ideas. But that is another debate for another matter, for another time. For the African group, in line with the understanding that we communicated and got the understanding at the subcommittee, annual subcommittee meeting, AMSEN is meeting from 12th to 16th of June, and hopefully we'll come back with our clearer idea on the table. I can assure you we'll not bring 5 resolutions, but I just wanted to have this point noted. But I thank again those regions, countries that have put forth the ideas for consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Mexico.
Thank you, Chair. And first of all, to thank you, the European Union, for signaling their intention on a number of resolutions. We are currently studying the possibility of presenting a resolution ourselves. We're looking at this with our Ministry of the Environment, but we're also studying the possibility, if we don't present a resolution in itself, to be able to add on to another resolution, because we have identified a lot of key issues. Regarding the proposals, we understand that these are just intentions on specific topics, and we see that there's some overlapping in some areas, and also the possibility of maybe consolidation into one bigger resolution or a couple of resolutions. So we would be very interested in engaging in that process. And as I said, if we do not present the resolution ourselves, we will be keen in strengthening some others that come up on the issues that we see as important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mexico. Brazil.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for all the colleagues that presented ideas for a resolution up to this point. I think this process is actually very interesting, because we have enough time to consider how best to merge these texts with significant time to prepare and to negotiate in the preparations for UNEA. And I think what it's most interest us about this process is that states can really see where the areas of common interest are. And we expect this to maybe make it possible for the states to get together and present a single text, a merged text, in order to facilitate consensus. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Brazil, EU.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the comments also addressed to the EU. Maybe first I should start with apologies for not meeting the deadline, to which we also agreed. The 30th of April proved to be difficult to have a comprehensive understanding of what we would like to address, and one of the obstacles was also the timelines for the background document, and hence this is a big caveat in our submission that we have some ideas put on the table, but we also look forward very much to see the background document that will be the backbone of our thinking, and we hope will be the backbone of our thinking for the UNEA outcome, both in terms of resolutions and the outcome document. I think it was very well interpreted by the Chair and also in other interventions that what we have submitted is by no means a proposal for resolutions. We are not going at all to table 7 resolutions. It was definitely topics that we would like to consider, and that's based on the quite wide and broad consultation among the EU member states would consider relevant to be addressed in the form of UNEA resolutions, one way or another. And we continue to believe strongly that the number of the resolutions should be very small, not excluding also the option of one resolution if we manage to address everything in one resolution. So I think the reference to the Karura Pact, I think it was more the intention of indicating a number of resolutions. I think even in that meeting we said that we would even go farther by reducing the number to less than the number of the regional groups, but of course we need to see how it goes. So with these intentions, we also would like to extend our declaration and interest to work with other member states who have intentions and ideas for resolutions. It's absolutely obvious that we've seen intentions from Norway or from the US on specific topics, and we would like to contribute with our ideas, and there are also other that are floating in the air at least, and we would like to cooperate with the others. On the timelines, I think the idea of getting together in a drafting exercise after the deadline of June sounds reasonable, but again, the milestone will be the background document, and we would really count that we can stick to the recommendations of content of that document as our basis for the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, EU. Colombia.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And Colombia will also like to thank the countries that have already presented intentions for resolution for UNEA. As stated by Brazil and Mexico, Colombia would like to call the attention on the need to prevent the duplicate of efforts and strive for coordinated and articulated resolution proposals that will be presented for comments and discussion. We think that if by any chance there are two or more resolutions addressing similar topics, we must, in a very early stage, and we are on time, to explore the possibility to work together and also try to consolidate in one single resolution. This is really a wish of our country. We want to thank the EU also for their will to work together within the region to try to reach this goal, and also for their will to work with our other regions on the different proposals that may arose during this UNEA event. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Colombia. Norway.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, as you've seen, Norway has submitted our wish to put forward a resolution on marine litter and microplastics, and seeing, as we say in our paper as well, that we see marine litter and microplastics as one of the great challenges of our time, and having worked on this issue now since UNEA 1, we see that many actions has been made in terms of knowledge and in terms of seeing what needs to be made, and we see now the need for action. Of course, we work very closely with the UNEP Secretariat and the experts, and we very much welcome also the interaction with interested countries. And of course, we are open to how this can be framed also to achieve the best possible outcome for this issue. Yes, I'll leave it with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Norway. Canada.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, colleagues. As others, perhaps I'll just begin by thanking all members who took the time and the initiative to put forth these themes on the table for further consideration. Canada is especially intrigued by input number 6 that was put forth by the EU on air pollution. In fact, Canada had been giving some internal thought and consideration to the prospect of proposing our own resolution on the same topic, given that air pollution is a common challenge for all UN environment regions that impacts human and ecosystem health, contributes to climate change, and places a significant burden on the global economy. Canada would like to take this opportunity to signal our willingness to consider co-sponsoring any resolution that might be tabled on air pollution, whether that's a standalone resolution or if it's consolidated into a broader resolution. And we look forward to working with the EU and its member states, and indeed all members, to develop and formulate any such resolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Canada. Switzerland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Switzerland's not yet on that list of countries which put forward possible resolutions, and I just want to give you briefly the reason why that is the case. In terms of timeline, we have the challenge that for many topics which are of interest to us, we have UNEA 2 resolutions, and we have requested there the Secretariat to come up with reports on these issues. And we feel that for certain topics, we would need to see these reports before we can decide whether we need to table a follow-up resolution on one or the other topic. So all I want to say is that the sooner we can receive the reports based on the UNEA or following up on the UNEA 2 resolutions, the faster we can come up with possible resolutions for UNEA 3. Thank you.
Thank you, Switzerland. If there are no other, Colombia? Oh, okay. Are there any other? No. Then maybe I might suggest the following. As ideas are coming in, maybe the Secretariat should merge these issues on areas of interest of pollution, like air, on air pollution, what, or soil pollution of the ideas, so we have a clear image of the areas and the emerging issues that the Member States are signaling. Maybe that would be helpful. And please, I completely agree with all Member States on cooperation, co-sponsorship, if you wish, on resolutions. And when we will see the initiators or the Member States who put forward ideas, anybody else who's interested can approach them and form a group of interest group working on that particular subject. And please don't forget that all resolutions not only has to be very short, but also has to have an actionable outcome. So when you are considering the topics, consider an actionable outcome, as we agreed on. And yes, the background documents are very important. We will have an initial brief by the executive director on May 24th. But we are welcoming any kind of unedited text that we can look at seriously, because we are running out of time. And if we have the final reports or final background documents in September, October, that would be really, really late. In the meantime, we can use the reports which will come out, as Jackie mentioned today. It's another report is coming out in June, so we can use that one. But we are looking forward to the background documents, even if it's not edited, even if informal briefings with groups of member states interested or subcommittee or whatever. Okay, on this note, we concluded agenda item number five. And we are going to any other matters. Are there any other matters on this? I would have one. We will have a joint bureau meeting on the 22nd, as we agreed to approve the structure. We will still looking forward for details on leadership dialogues from the Secretariat, and many other issues like briefings on private sector, and there was one more that you can brief us when we will have these briefings or documents. And on this particular meeting, joint bureau meeting on the 22nd, we will agree on the agenda for the joint retreat in June. So we will be able to brief you on, and also the members of the Bureau will be able to brief the regional and political groups on the agenda. But we will also brief you on the 24th after the Executive Director's intervention. Jorge?
Thank you very much, Madam Ambassador. Just to emphasize, as it has been communicated to you, that on the 24th, and the Executive Director will participate in the subcommittee, and it's at the request of Member States who have encouraged him to attend a meeting of the subcommittee level, and he will provide an update. The Executive Director will also present the, an update, a progress, will introduce the advances that we have achieved so far in terms of the report, the background report for the 2017 Environment Assembly. You'll be also pleased to know that in that meeting we will also present to you the thinking of the Secretariat in terms of the dialogues and the organization of the leadership dialogue. So at least that's one wish that's been taken into account, and we are looking forward to implementing it. We have also received and taken note of our request on private sector briefing and have requested further clarification, which was provided to us as a matter of fact. We are looking into the possibility of scheduling that briefing on private sector more towards after the summer, because indeed it is our understanding that members are interested in knowing from a structural perspective how UN environment is engaging the private sector. So that requires some thought, some work, and we will communicate to you very soon the date in which that briefing will be thus taken into account. The last point that you didn't mention explicitly, Madam Chair, it's the one I suppose you were referring to, the side events. Side events as well. And the in that regard, yes, we're working on a proposal as which is linked to the endorsement of the structure. That's why we're looking forward to the structure being endorsed by the joint meeting of the bureaus. This is what I have to update until now, and obviously we will be, you know, communicating. We'll be seeing you on the 24th and provide further information if required.
Okay. And also there was a request to have a briefing or a paper on the name of UNEP, to avoid any kind of discussions, potential discussions at the Assembly. We have to avoid any kind of controversial discussion. So if you can provide that particular one, that would be very, very grateful. So if there is no other comment, thank you very much for your active participation. And I declare the meeting closed. Have a good afternoon.